Welcome everybody to the teleclass today, the 14th of January, the first of the UK teleclasses in 2009. As we're aware, Clostridium difficile is giving us a lot of problems in healthcare today. We've seen cases rise in recent years, and along with MRSA in the UK, it's now an organism that has to be compulsory reported to give us an idea of the national picture. Professor Wilcox has been long recognised as an expert in the management of Clostridium difficile, and we're very pleased that he's agreed to speak to us for today's teleclass. He is currently consultant microbiologist, head of microbiology and clinical director of pathology at the Leeds Teaching Hospitals, and professor of medical microbiology at the University of Leeds, and is the lead on Clostridium difficile infection for the Health Protection Agency's regional microbiology network in England. He's a member of the Department of Health's Antimicrobial Resistance and Healthcare Associated Infection Committee, and his research projects have been far and wide, but has been very much linked to a very large number of papers on Clostridium difficile infection. I'd like to thank Virox Technologies for sponsoring the teleclass program. They don't sponsor Professor Wilcox directly, but they do provide support for us to allow healthcare professionals in developing nations the opportunity to have unlimited free access to teleclass educational materials. So now, without further ado, I'd like to thank Professor Wilcox for presenting today and to invite him to speak to us on Clostridium difficile, prevention is better than cure, the environmental perspective. Over to you, Professor Wilcox.
Hello, everybody, and good morning or good afternoon, wherever you are. I am going to concentrate almost entirely on the environmental aspects of preventing C. diff infection. I will touch on some other aspects, but really I'm trying to focus on the environment. C. diff is widely distributed in the natural environment. These data that you can see were collected in the late 1990s, actually from South Wales in the UK. And the place where they're collected doesn't really matter. But as you can see from these prevalence data, they show just how extensively distributed C. difficile is in the environment. So we see that the organism is recoverable from many different water sources, including, rather intriguingly, from one out of 18 mains chlorinated tap water samples. Those tap water samples were actually taken from a hospital main supply. I suspect that the fact that C. diff was found in one of those samples probably pertains to biofilm buildup in old pipework, but I can't confirm that. In addition to water, obviously we find C. diff and indeed other clostridial spores in soil and indeed in things that come into contact with soil. So you can find C. diff on raw vegetables. The prevalence here probably just reflects the degree of washing that those vegetables have been exposed to. You can find C. diff in the inanimate environment of private houses, homes, people, uncommonly. But you can also find the organism in cats' feces and dog feces. And coming more up to date, I'm not going to talk about this today, but we find C. diff in particular, newer epidemic C. diff strains, in other animals as well, notably pigs, particularly piglets, and horses. But I'm not going to mention C. diff in animals for the remainder of this talk. If you compare those prevalences just talked about with a rough prevalence, at least in the context of this study in the late 1990s, of about 20% of sites were C. diff positive in four different hospitals when they were sampled. So you can see the organism is widely distributed. Next slide. The reason C. diff is so commonly found in a nutshell is because it forms spores. And you can see what the spores look like here when they're stained with acridine orange. Acridine orange stains for RNA, and RNA is only produced by bacteria cells that are actively metabolizing. And so you can see that although there are some vegetative spores on this slide, that the long, slender organisms, there are spores as well, which are the shorter, rounder organisms, but you can see that the spores also light up with acridine orange to some extent. And that reflects the fact that although the organism is relatively dormant, it is actually still alive. It's just waiting for the right conditions before it decides to germinate. Next slide. These data were collected from a brand new elderly medical ward that up until the early part of October, and this was way back in the 1990s now we did this study, up until early October, it was a dining room, a hospital dining room, and then because of need for more hospital beds, it was converted obviously over a period of time, and it actually opened officially on the 7th of October in this particular year. So the day before it opened, on the 6th of October, we took multiple samples, environmental samples, from bay floors, from toilet floors, and from the other sites shown on the slide. And you can see that from none of those samples, and I stress there were multiple samples from each of those sites, none of those samples initially yielded C. difficile on culture. However, within a week of the ward opening, we start to see at least some of the samples from the bay floors, and there were more than one sample from there, that was C. diff positive. And gradually, as you move from left to right, through the months from October through December, and into the next year, January, towards the end of January, the 31st of January, you see gradually more and more sites becoming C. diff positive. And remember that this is despite routine, regular, daily, and then additional weekly cleaning that was going on at that time, as was practiced throughout the hospital and throughout the NHS. And this was actually detergent-based cleaning, which was the norm at that time. In between the end of January, the 31st of January, and the 9th of April, that particular elderly medical ward was affected by an outbreak of viral gastroenteritis. So the ward was restricted to new admissions, and it had a so-called deep clean, which is the term is often used in the NHS in the UK. And when people say, what does deep cleaning mean? Well, cynically, we could sometimes say, well, what it means is cleaning properly. And you can see that the effect of that deep clean was to reduce the burden of C. difficile. At least one can deduce that, one can't prove that. But C. difficile was still present after the deep clean had taken place. And the data in the bottom right-hand corner of the slide show that on the 9th of April, 1996, this is the study was done, 95 to 96. On that date in April, just over two-thirds of high dust sites, so these are sites beyond the normal reach of cleaners, of routine daily or weekly cleaning, more than two-thirds of those sites were C. diff positive, remembering that the other sites that were in the main body of this slide are mainly low dust sites that are easily reached and easily cleaned. So the takeaway message here is that routine cleaning does not control buildup of C. diff in the environment in a setting where patients will have C. diff infection, certainly routine cleaning with detergent, that is, and that indeed some sites become heavily contaminated, in particular high dust sites, sites beyond the reach of normal cleaning. The next slide. And this was a different study where we were, again, following C. diff in the environment. And really the only reason I show this is to emphasize that you can find C. diff from multiple sites, but the sites most commonly contaminated by C. difficile are those sites that come into contact with feces. So quite simply, commodes, number one culprit in terms of C. diff positivity, followed by toilet floors, and then other sorts of floors thereafter. Obviously, floors that presumably come into contact either with feces directly or indirectly via the feet of patients or healthcare workers moving around from contaminated areas to what were non-contaminated areas. So the organism is widely distributed, and indeed the commodes at this time, admittedly at a time where there wasn't as much attention as there maybe is today on cleanliness and scrupulous cleanliness of items in the hospital environment, but these commodes, as you can see, the great majority of them were C. diff positive, and these were commodes ready for use by another patient, which is a rather worrying observation, obviously. Next slide. Again, a different study where we were looking for C. difficile, but now looking specifically in single room accommodation. which had been used to isolate patients with C. difficile. So once the patient with C. difficile had been discharged from this single room accommodation in the hospital, we then sampled the environment at the times stated on the slide to see whether we could recover C. difficile. Obviously, the room would be cleaned after the patient was discharged, and then within a relatively short space of time, it would be filled with another patient, and again, then daily cleaning and or weekly cleaning would be carried out. And you can see that from the 33 single rooms that had been occupied by C. diff patients that we studied, from only two of them could we not isolate C. difficile subsequent to discharge. From about a third of the rooms, they remain C. diff positive, at least some of the samples, environmental samples, are positive for up to 2 weeks. And from four of the rooms, samples are positive for up to a month, 4 weeks. And those data pertain to the actual numbers of rooms. When you add all the samples taken from multiple samples from each room, then after a month, 4 weeks, a quarter of all the sites sampled were still C. difficile positive, remembering some of these samples, again, would be beyond the normal reach of routine cleaning. Next slide. It's worth stressing that those data were obtained after we'd done some earlier studies where we'd optimized the way in which you can recover C. difficile from the environment, and indeed recovery of C. difficile in general. And the reason I stress this is that if you're tempted to do any sampling, particularly where C. difficile is found in low numbers, because although the data I've shown you show that the organism is widely spread, the actual numbers of organisms you find on any one site in any one sample can be very low, and you need to have optimal culture methods and enrichment methods, otherwise you won't recover C. difficile. So even using a standard C. difficile specific medium, CCEY, which effectively is Brazier's medium, a medium used commonly in the UK and Europe for isolation of C. difficile, you'll see that you can markedly increase the recovery of C. difficile by doing one of two things. You can either enrich the sample using an alkaline thioglycolate broth, or, and indeed more simply, just simply incorporate lysozyme at 5 milligrams per litre into the actual Brazier's medium. So that's why it's called CCEY plus lysozyme. And that results in a marked increase, significant increase, in the recovery rate of C. difficile from these environmental samples. And to this date, we continue to use this method. You might wonder, well, what is lysozyme doing? Well, we think, and there is some data to support this, some old data from the literature, that lysozyme is able to break open the spore coat that C. difficile has when it's in the environmental setting. And there is a term which is called superdormant spores, where some spores seem to be much more difficult to get to germinate and so to culture successfully. And it's only by using these specialized methods, particular lysozyme, that can help to encourage superdormant spores to germinate and so increase recovery rates. Next slide. This cartoon slide is simply to illustrate the conundrum of whether, when we find C. difficile in the environment, is it a causative problem or is it just really a reflection of the fact that some patients in that setting are excreting C. difficile, so hence chicken or egg. And I'll try and build on this point. Next slide. Here we've got two wards. It doesn't matter which specific ones they are, but they're elderly medical wards, the same design, same setup, same types of patients, the same hospital block at the same time. Here just called Ward A, Ward B. And if you simply ask the question, does the burden of C. difficile infection, here represented in yellow by the number of new toxin-positive patients in each of these bimonthly periods, does that correlate with the prevalence of C. difficile in the environment? And you can see that on the left in Ward A, the answer is yes. There's a correlation between the two. So when you get more C. difficile positive patients, you get more environmental sites that are positive, and or vice versa. This isn't telling us about causality, it's just saying whether there's an association. However, the same is not true on Ward B. So same design ward, same type of patients, and yet there appears to be here little or no correlation between the burden of C. difficile infection and the amount of C. difficile in the environment. These are essentially observational data, and there's lots of potential for confounding here. In particular, you could argue that one ward is cleaned more effectively than the other, and that contamination of the environment is more frequent in one setting rather than the other. And there's lots of reasons why these differences could arise. But the reason for emphasizing this point is that if you were to carry out a study on one ward, one area only, you can find misleading results, and you need to do these sorts of studies in different settings, even if they're similar settings, but you need to have an N size greater than one. Otherwise, you could falsely assume that what you find in one setting is exactly the same in another setting, and that's not necessarily the case. Next slide. These now old data, well over a decade old, are very elegant and simply make the association between the prevalence of C. difficile in the environment and the likelihood that the hands of healthcare workers working in those environments are C. difficile positive. On the left-hand side, you can see the prevalence of C. difficile increasing from zero to more than half of the sites sampled. And on the right-hand side, you can see the associated prevalence of contaminated, C. difficile contaminated hands of the healthcare workers going from zero up to more than a third of the hands sampled. This is just spot sampling with C. difficile positive as the environment became more contaminated. Now again, this is not a proof of cause and effect, but it's highly likely and highly biologically plausible that environmental contamination is related to the contamination of healthcare workers' hands. And therefore, we can see very simply an elegant demonstration of how environmental contamination may be contributing to spread of C. difficile. Next slide. Coming much closer to real time here, a study was published in Archives of Internal Medicine in 2007, where the term CDAD pressure, CDAD is largely now a term that is falling out of use, and guidelines to be published this week in the UK and soon in Europe and indeed in North America are all going to use the term CDI, C. difficile infection. But it doesn't matter whether you use CDI or CDAD in this context. This particular study was attempting to describe the effect of exposure to cases of C. difficile infection on other patients. In other words, was this a risk factor for developing C. difficile infection in C. diff naive patients? And they had two studies, a retrospective cohort study where they basically looked at all their patients in this modest size US hospital who had C. difficile infection. It was just over 382 cases of CDI in the year. And they did a nested case control study within that whole cohort. So those 382 patients, they then found controls for all of them and asked the question, what was the CDAD pressure, I call it CDI transmission pressure, for those cases versus controls? And CDI transmission pressure was simply exposure to other symptomatic CDI cases. And you can see that the pressure, the CDAD pressure, was much higher, 1.4 versus 0.3, 1.4 for cases, 0.3 for controls, and that was a highly significant difference. And indeed, of the 382 cases of CDI, only one of them had a CDAD pressure of zero. In other words, exposure to no other known CDI patients. And when they did the nested case control study where they controlled for other risk factors, most noticeably antibiotic usage, CDAD transmission pressure, CDI transmission pressure, was still a significant independent risk factor. And this, to me, is a rather complicated way of doing it, but again, simple message that transmission of C. difficile is a key risk factor for developing infection, and that's independent of antibiotic exposure. Next slide. Some very modern day data published only last year, 2008. These data are quite provocative, and they need to be reproduced before we can be certain really what they mean. And they were obtained from long-term care facility settings, so effectively nursing home type settings in the US. And the long-term care facilities had been affected by C. difficile outbreak. So again, these figures may be inflated. But the message here that in this outbreak setting is that whether you look at skin contamination of patients in that setting or environmental contamination around those same patients, rather surprisingly, the burden of skin carriage or environmental contamination was just as high in asymptomatic C. diff carriers as it was in patients who were symptomatic with C. diff infection. And if you contrast those rates of either skin contamination at the top or environmental contamination at the bottom with the rates in non-C. diff affected patients, so patients who had been symptomatic nor were carriers, you can see that there is a clear distinction there. This is a bit of an alert, a bit of a wake-up that asymptomatic carriers could be an important source of C. diff for transmission. Now, the reason I'm being cautious here is that I would not advocate screening for asymptomatic carriage, because quite simply there isn't an effective intervention that's been described for those carriers, and certainly treating them with antibiotics to rid them of C. diff has been shown to be not effective and indeed maybe detrimental. So I'm not advocating screening. What I am saying is that high standard of cleanliness and attention to hygiene is important not only for your C. diff affected patients, but also for those who are carrying C. diff. And of course, you won't know who's carrying C. diff. And as I say, I don't think it's worth screening them, because a screen positive result will be difficult to handle and to know what to do with. Next slide. There are a number of controversies with respect to how to rid the environment of C. difficile. I'm going to mention some of these in the remainder of the talk. If I just start at the bottom of this slide, I am going to present some data concerning the different sorts of chlorine-containing agents. And there are two main groups of chlorine-containing agents. There's hypochlorate agents and there's dichloroisocyanurate-containing agents. And they tend to be viewed as just altogether chlorine-releasing agents. But actually, they may differ in terms of effects on C. difficile. I'm not going to present any data comparing 1,000 versus 5,000 parts per million chlorine and their effectiveness, but suffice it to say that there are data to show that 1,000 parts per million may be effective, is effective at controlling C. difficile. So what is clear is if you insist on using 5,000 parts per million, you will cause relatively rapid environmental damage to those areas exposed to chlorine-releasing agents. So I would advocate using the lower concentration, 1,000 parts per million, to gain the effect you want with respect to C. difficile. I'll talk about where and when chlorine-based cleaning should be used as well. To move then to the top of the slide, I am going to mention something about microfiber products on the next slide. I'm not going to talk about steam cleaning. There aren't good data available, to my knowledge, showing the effectiveness of steam cleaning to rid the environment of C. difficile. One would expect it should be reasonably effective, providing that all surfaces, including crevices and so on, are adequately exposed to steam, vapor steam. Remembering, of course, that spores are relatively resistant to heat. They shouldn't be resistant to steam, providing you can get superheated steam to come into contact with the spores. But as I say, there's a lack of data there. I'm also not going to show you any data specifically about vaporized hydrogen peroxide, H2O2. To cut a long story short here, there is reasonable evidence that hydrogen peroxide, vaporized hydrogen peroxide, can effectively decontaminate the environment of a wide range of bacteria, but including C. difficile. The problem I have with vaporized hydrogen peroxide is twofold. One is the practicality and sheer cost of using this approach to decontaminate areas of the hospital, and in particular having to vacate those areas, certainly of patients, whilst the decontamination is carried out. And often that is practically extremely difficult or nigh on impossible in a busy healthcare setting. The other issue, which to my knowledge has not been addressed, are environmental concerns about what happens to hydrogen peroxide. Where does it go once it's been released into the atmosphere? Does it have any long-term effects? Does it have any effects on surfaces and so on? And those points need to be addressed. Next slide, I'd just like to talk briefly about microfiber cleaning. Now, some of the listeners to this talk today might not be familiar with microfiber cleaning. It is a mode of cleaning that has been used more, to my knowledge, in Europe and obviously in the UK included. And there was a vogue for using this really starting about 5 years ago, certainly in the UK. And you can use these microfiber products, which effectively are products that look like normal cleaning products, whether they are dusters, cloths, mops, but actually their surface is composed of tiny fibers, very closely arrayed, which are said to be more effective at removing particles from surfaces, and those particles could include bacteria. And you can use these products, you can buy them indeed just from ordinary stores to be used in the home setting. And you can use them dry or you can use them wet with water. But the problem is if you start exposing those fibers to chemicals that might have chlorine or other disinfectants in them, then the microfibers can coalesce together and then the physical properties of those products are lost in terms of particle removal. Some products are designed, and most of them indeed are designed to be reprocessed after having been used, so rewashed, but of course that can incur some damage to the microfibers. There may be question marks about how frequently reprocessing can occur, and there are practical difficulties about doing that. So as an alternative, there are single-use microfiber products which are simpler to use, remove the need for reprocessing, but may have cost and indeed ecological issues related to them because of the large quantities to be used. The other key thing about them is that if you're not using a disinfectant or indeed detergent, just using water, if you don't use these products, in particular cloths, when you're cleaning surfaces, if you don't use them in a standardized way, then you may simply move bacteria and particles from one relatively contaminated surface to another surface. And so there are methods known as such as the eightfold method, where you sequentially expose different parts of the cloth to the surfaces that you're cleaning so that you do not use a contaminated part of the cloth when you come to your next surface. The next slide shows some data to illustrate, however, that microfiber cloths are not all created equal. This is two figures from one study, from 2006 study by Moore and Griffith. If you concentrate on the top figure, figure one, where they were looking at the amount of either organic debris or microorganisms that were removed from a surface, from a pre-contaminated surface. So the higher those bars, the better. That means more removal of debris or microorganisms. But what you can see is that there are six different microfiber products, MF1 to MF6. They're not all the same. And indeed, one of them, MF2, is clearly inferior to some of the others. And indeed, MF2 appears to be inferior to a general purpose cleaning cloth and is no better than a paper towel at removing organic debris or microorganisms. In fact, it's much worse at removing microorganisms than a paper towel is, which would not give anybody any confidence of it being used, certainly in a healthcare setting and indeed in other settings as well. So there's lots of question marks about microfiber products. to my mind, which means that I would not recommend introducing these as a way of gaining control with respect to C. difficile. If you're already using them, I would hone in on those areas I've illustrated, particularly about reprocessing. I would consider the issue of single use, but ensure that if they are being used, that people know how they should be being used so that they don't risk recontaminating surfaces. The next slide. This is just to make a brief point that I've already referred to parts per million chlorine, and it's important that if ever you are referring to concentrations of chlorine-containing compounds, that you stick to that terminology, the parts per million, ppm, and do not use percentage strength. So refer to, for example, a 10% dilution or a 1 in 10, whatever. And the reason for that is that neat bleach is not the same in every situation. And for example, neat bleach in the US contains less chlorine in terms of parts per million than does neat bleach in the UK. And you'll get variations, obviously, in other countries as well. And the reason neat bleach isn't as strong, if you like, concentrated in the US is for safety reasons, that a decision was made to reduce the concentration of that. So you can see that if you start, products, don't respect borders, they can move across borders. And if you simply refer to a concentration by its percentage relative to neat solution, you can be severely misled as to the actual number of parts per million of available chlorine, which is the key issue regarding efficacy of these products. So stick to ppm. Next slide. This is just to highlight for the UK people listening to this talk, this will be no surprise to you. You remember that about a year ago there was lots of publicity about a deep cleaning initiative in the NHS, and this was probably something of a gimmick to highlight efforts to control healthcare-associated infection. Now, by saying it was a bit of a gimmick, I'm not suggesting it was harmful. Anything that can increase standards of environmental hygiene is to be welcomed. But a one-off deep cleaning program where a ward or area is cleaned isn't what's necessary. What is necessary is regular, high-quality cleaning that stops the sort of reaccumulation of C. difficile and other organisms that I've alluded to earlier in this talk. Next slide. Now I want to show you some data that we first published in 2000 in The Lancet. And these were data carried out entirely in a laboratory setting. And so there remains a question mark about their applicability in situ. But the data are reproducible and are worrying. And what we looked at was the capacity of three different C. diff strains, a blue, red, and cream-colored strain, as in this slide, to form spores. And that was just naturally to form spores when we expose a suspension just to allow them to air dry. And you can see that the three strains are not the same in terms of their propensity, as shown on the left-hand side for control, in terms of their ability to form spores, that the blue strain forms spores more effectively. And that blue strain, indeed, was a well-described epidemic strain prevalent in the UK at that time. But rather surprisingly, when you expose those strains to low concentrations just below the levels needed to kill the spores, and then re-carry out these counts, these spore counts, you'll see that, interestingly, detergent compounds, which are Hospec, D2 and D4, actually markedly increase the capacity of all three of those strains to form spores. Whereas the same is not true for the two chlorine-containing compounds that we studied, DevaCare and Saniclor. And you can see the error bars for the extensive sporulation overlap with the error bars for the control strains, so no difference. So the implications of this could be that if you use detergent-based cleaning and exposing which indeed detergent will not kill C. difficile, then you might actually be encouraging some C. difficile strains, particularly if they've just been excreted by a patient and are present in a vegetative form, you may be encouraging sporulation to occur. And therefore, once you've got sporulation, that form of C. difficile becomes that much harder to remove from the environment. Next slide. We reproduced those data, those 2000 data, in a further study published in an American infection control journal, ICCHI, in 2007. And this time we used more up-to-date strains. So we used a UK epidemic strain, which is the blue strain from the original slide. But now, by this time, remember, ribotype 027, NAP1, or BI as it's known in Canada and in the US, had come on the scene. So we used that strain as well. We used a non-outbreak strain. And we also used another strain, which at the time we called a non-outbreak strain, a ribotype 078, but actually that's now causing outbreaks in certain settings, notably in the Netherlands as we speak. And essentially, we found the same phenomenon. So we changed the strains, we brought the strains more up to date, but we found, again, exposure to detergent, and that's in this case non-ionic surfactant and phosphate, that's the second set of data from the left-hand side, they caused increased sporulation, more clearly seen with some strains than others, but that was the reproducible phenomenon. So again, exposure to low concentrations of detergent makes sporulation more common in these strains. That wasn't seen when we exposed the strains to dichloroisocyanurate-containing compounds, or the chlorine-containing compounds that had chlorine in this NADCC format. One of those products was a pure chlorine-containing product, and the other one had a detergent in it as well. And you can see that those products do not cause sporulation. Interestingly, there was a different product we looked at that was, again, a combination of detergents, and this time the chlorine was in a hyperchlorite form, and that did cause some increase in sporulation. And again, rather worryingly, a liquid hydrogen peroxide product that was in use in US hospitals at the time of this study also caused increased sporulation as well when used in sublethal concentrations. The next slide shows actually the degree of activity of these different compounds that we looked at. Indeed, it tells you what the compounds are. And I don't really want to concentrate on that. Really, if you just concentrate on the far right-hand side, that really shows the safety margin in terms of how much you can dilute these different compounds, these different disinfectants, and yet still obtain inhibition of C. difficile. So some compounds are actually very active against C. difficile, but others are less so. And this is against the vegetative forms of C. difficile, importantly, not against the spores. And the next two slides, starting with the one labelled about CD001, that's an epidemic strain shown in the previous data, UK epidemic strain, also prevalent in some other countries, including Canada, shows that now looking at the effects of these different compounds, the same cleaning detergent and disinfectant compounds used at working strength, so diluted to the strengths recommended by the manufacturers, shows that in three settings, these did not kill C. diff spores, whereas in the other three it did. So for no treatment, obviously had no effect on spores. G-force, which is the liquid hydrogen peroxide at working strength, did not kill C. diff spores, and neither did Hospec, which is the detergent. Whereas the other three compounds, the three different chlorine-containing compounds, ChlorClean, Saniclor, and Dispatch, all effectively killed C. diff spores at working concentrations. The next slide is a similar data set, but this time using a C. diff 027 NAP1 BI epidemic strain. It's exactly the same findings. Three of the compounds do not kill C. difficile, whereas the other three disinfectants do. The next slide just reviews some studies that have actually been now not moving from the laboratory setting to the clinic setting to show the effects of intervening in terms of cleaning to remove C. difficile and indeed control rates of C. difficile infection. I'm just going to talk briefly about each of these studies. The first study, next slide, is an old study now from cats. In 1988, following an outbreak of C. difficile infection, they introduced hyperchlorite cleaning initially with 500 parts per million and then later increased that concentration to 1,600 parts per million of available chlorine. And they showed that they initially reduced surface contamination but reduced it even further and indeed got control of their outbreak once they instituted that higher level of cleaning. Now, they did lots of other things as well at the time, so one can't assume that this was the only important intervention, but it was a start to provide some data that chlorine-based cleaning may be efficacious in controlling CDI. The next slide shows a study from the US by Mayfield and colleagues, where they managed to reduce significantly the incidence of CDI in a bone marrow transplant unit by instituting hyperchlorite-based cleaning. Now, you notice here that they were using a high concentration, 5,000 parts per million, for environmental disinfection. And up until using this, they'd been using a quaternary ammonium compound for routine cleaning. They then went back to introducing quaternary ammonium compounds, and the CDI incidence went back up to baseline levels, which is pretty good evidence that the hyperchlorite-based cleaning was efficacious in this case. Unfortunately, they didn't measure environmental C. difficile prevalence. They altered the antibiotic use in general during the study, and they didn't find the same effect in another setting, but the other settings had a much lower rate of C. diff, so it might have been not possible to reduce an already low rate of infection. The third study was a study we carried out and published in 2003, and we did this in the setting of a crossover ward design. So we had two elderly medical wards, one of which we carried on routine cleaning with detergent, and the other one at the same time we cleaned routinely with a detergent and chlorine release combination agent, indeed one of the agents that we used in the earlier in vitro studies. After 6-month periods, we crossed the wards over, so they switched back and switched to the other form of cleaning. You can see on the x-axis in this figure, the asterisks represent quarters when we were carrying out chlorine-based cleaning. And these are just data for one of the two elderly medical wards. And you can see that towards the end of that chlorine-based cleaning period, we saw a significant decrease in the incidence of C. difficile infection. We saw some effect on the prevalence of C. difficile in the environment, and indeed the reduction in C. diff incidence in patients was seen just after, coincidental with, rather, the decrease in prevalence of C. diff in the environment. Now, we didn't see a mirror image of these effects in the other ward that we studied, which again emphasizes the fact that you may not get a uniform effect in multiple areas. But this was reasonably good evidence when we were controlling for exposure to C. difficile, where we could reduce infection rates associated with chlorine-based cleaning. But just briefly, there were at least two other studies I just wanted to show you. This slide shows you the effect of introducing cleaning after discharge of patients from a room, so-called terminal cleaning, and showed that in a before and after study design setting, there was an apparent reduction in C. difficile infection rates with the introduction of terminal room cleaning with bleach. However, to be skeptical, you can see the intervention period in the graph in the bottom right-hand corner of the slide, and you can see that the incidence of C. difficile infection was already falling at the time when they introduced the intervention, i.e. started terminal cleaning. So this type of study, it's very difficult to actually conclude whether the intervention was the effective thing or whether other measures that were going on concurrently were also having an effect. The next slide is a study published in an online journal. This was published in 2008. And again, quite a small study here looking at the effects of environmental cleaning with chlorine-containing compounds and showing really with, again, small numbers that there appeared to be a beneficial effect in terms of removal of C. diff from the environment by using bleach. And that was in contrast to cleaning with standard cleaning and indeed initially to cleaning with bleach but by routine housekeepers. So in other words, when that was introduced, there was only a modest decrease, which wasn't significant, in C. diff prevalence, but that was much more pronounced when you got some very carefully controlled cleaning being carried out using bleach. Next slide shows guidance that will appear in CDI guidelines that are about to be published in the UK, and really just give you a flavour of the sort of emphasis that's being put there. There's nothing new here for those listening to this talk in the UK setting. But essentially, the main cleaning approach, disinfectant approach for the environment in the context of C. difficile is chlorine-based. That is the recommendation, using at least 1,000 parts per million chlorine for the reasons that I said earlier. Now, many hospitals where C. difficile is endemic have extended these guidelines already. These have been effectively in use for some time to the entire hospital setting, or certainly the setting of all those wards in the hospital where C. difficile is reasonably common, rather than simply using this approach for only for individual C. difficile patients. Of course, the problem being you don't know which is the next C. difficile patient, and therefore a wider usage of this approach is probably likely to be more effective than simply using it once individual cases occur. I'm not advocating using this if you don't have a C. difficile problem, of course. Next slide is a cartoon slide as I move towards the end of the talk now, just to illustrate the fact that, rather like for those of us who have children, our kids' bedrooms, which can be something of a no-go area with debris everywhere, we need to remove all unnecessary items from the general ward environment, because anything that's on the floor, anything that's stopping routine cleaning being carried out effectively will potentially increase contamination rates with C. difficile and indeed with other organisms. And my last slide today is really just to illustrate that there are a series of risk factors, only one of which have I concentrated on today, that increase the risk for C. difficile infection. Now, the risk factors in this list, there are seven risk factors I've listed here. Those in yellow are risk factors that we can do something about. We can obviously alter which antibiotics our patients are exposed to. We may choose not to use antibiotics if we have good restrictive policies in place. The knock-on effect of that is that there'll be less gut flora inhibition. And we can do something about altering patients' host response using sometimes immunoglobulin therapy for some cases, possibly in the future by using vaccines. But the key that I've been talking about today, the key control measure, is by controlling and reducing patients' risk of C. difficile infection by reducing their exposure to the organism itself. The other three risk factors for C. diff infection that are in this list are largely factors that we cannot control. We can't control the age of our patients. It's difficult for us to control the biology of the strains that we see, whether how resistant they are, and therefore the likelihood of them being selected, and indeed their virulence in terms of toxin and other determinants. So again, the emphasis should be on controlling exposure to C. difficile, and in particular, environmental exposure. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Professor Wilcox. A really interesting, thought-provoking presentation. I can certainly relate to the kids' bedroom problem. I think I'm going to introduce hypochlorite in the cleaning of my son's bedroom. A very strong message, I think, there on the importance of the environment in the control of CDI. Can I thank you again? A very interesting talk. And also thank again Virox Technologies for giving us the support to enable developing countries to tune in free of charge. Thank you all for tuning in, and we hope you come to future teleclasses too. Thank you very much, and goodbye.